where QR codes kill kittens and customer service is an oxymoron, one podcast has set out to make things right. This is The Unpodcast with your hosts, Scott Stratton and Allison Kramer.
Welcome to WKRP in Cincinnati.
His name is Les, right?
Les Nessman?
Les Nessman. Yeah,
that's right.
Cincinnati. I can't remember the time of my appointments, but I can remember that the guy on WKRP in Cincinnati's name was Les. I was half an hour early for an appointment this morning, and I told the other person meeting us to come a half an hour late.
The turkey drop story from that show. It's one of the most legendary TV sitcom clips in history. If you haven't seen it, millennials, look it up. WKRP turkey drop. Just do it. We'll put a link to it on the show notes, but you got to see it on the show today. A whole bunch of stuff and nothing more. Yeah, it makes sense.
It's pretty good.
This is from thehustle.co. So you know they're cool because they got a .co. I just think they always forget the M. This is called The Men Who Took 10,000 Flights. The rise and demise of the AA Air Pass, American Airlines $250,000 lifetime ticket. The 1980s, American Airlines sold an unlimited first-class ticket for life, but they didn't account for super travelers like Jacques Vroom and Steve Rothstein. 3 decades ago, 28 lucky bastards managed to snag the greatest travel deal in history, courtesy of American Airlines. It was dubbed the Unlimited Air Pass, but it's like AA Pass. For a one-time fee of $250,000, or $560K in 2018 dollars, this pass gave a buyer unlimited first-class travel for life. A companion pass could be purchased for an additional $150K, allowing the pass holder to bring along anyone for the ride. Mark Cuban, an early Air Passer, tells us it was one of the best purchases he's ever made. But the unlimited Air Pass had a fatal flaw. It was such a good deal that it ended up costing American Airlines millions of dollars per year. And the company set out to revoke the contracts of its top customers by any means necessary. So American had been hit hard by the Airline Deregulation Act of 1978. They had posted a $76 million loss in 1980 and were grappling with new competition, reduced ticket prices, and a changing industry that threatened to sink them into irrelevancy. The airline's newly elected president, Robert Crandall, was on a mission to cut American down to the bone and lead a massive expansion from the ground up. American needed cash, but interest rates were at a record high. So they came up with a different plan. They'd raise capital from their own customer base by selling its wealthiest customers the ultimate travel perk. The idea was that firms would buy this for their top performers, Crandall tells us over the phone. But as usual, the public is way smarter than any corporation. People immediately figured out we'd made a mistake pricing-wise. By 1994, American had discontinued the unlimited pass, but not before 28 people got the deal of a lifetime. Steve Rothstein, then an investment banker in Chicago, was already one of American Airlines' top flyers when he was approached to buy the pass in the early 80s. American Airlines contacted me and said that based on the amount I traveled, the Air Pass would be a great purchase. It was like a bond. Instead of paying me dividends in cash, they were paying dividends in air travel. They needed cash, and they could pay me in miles. For a total of $383,000, Rothstein purchased both an AA Pass and Companion Pass, and over the next 25 years, he proceeded to book more than 10,000 flights. He took hundreds of trips in New York, LA, and San Francisco. He went to London, sometimes a dozen times per month. He flew up to Ontario just for a sandwich. On occasion, he'd offer his Companion Pass to a complete stranger at the airport. The contract was truly unlimited, he says, so why not use it as intended? As a little sidebar here, it says he took 1,000 flights to New York, 500 to San Fran, 500 to LA, 500 to London, 120 to Tokyo, 80 to Paris, 80 to Sydney, 50 to Hong Kong. Excuse me, 50 to Hong Kong. Over in Texas, a direct marketing catalog consultant by the name of Jacques Vroom also decided to shell out the $400K for the pass and companion pass. He says, I had never bought anything for $400K in my life, but I took out a loan for 12% for 5 years and did it because I thought it would give me a competitive advantage for life. Over the next 2 decades, Vroom flew an average of 2 million miles per year.
Wow.
He used his pass to catch all of his son's football games on the East Coast. He popped over to France or London just to have lunch with a friend. When his daughter had a middle school project on South American culture, he took her to Buenos Aires to see a rodeo and then flew back the next day.
That's amazing.
Like Rothstein, Vroom trusted the sanctity of the contract he'd signed with American Airlines. They used the word unlimited in lifetime, he says. And then the mother effers took it all away. Decades later, in 2007, American once again found itself in financial straits. The company's revenue integrity team found the AAR Pass users cost the company big bucks, and they homed in on the program's two most prolific users, Steve Rothstein and Jacques Vroom. American calculated that Rothstein and Vroom were each costing the airline $1 million per year in taxes, fees, and lost ticket sales. It didn't take long for the airline to find reasons to revoke the duo's passes. According to documents unearthed by the LA Times reporter Ken Bensinger, Rothstein had made 3,000 reservations in a span of 4 years and canceled 2,500 of them. Vroom booked flights for strangers and allegedly accepted payment for tickets on certain occasions. Neither of these practices were barred in the original contract. Nonetheless, American Airlines categorized them as fraudulent activity and formed an elaborate operation to take down Rothstein and Vroom. In July 2008, Vroom was cornered by agents at London Heathrow's airport. Several months later, Rothstein was stopped while boarding a flight to Chicago O'Hare. Both men were stripped of their passes and told they'd never fly in the airline again.
Wow.
Rothstein and Vroom both filed lawsuits against American Airlines for the wrongful termination of their contracts, but were outmatched by the airline's bazillion lawyers. Then in 2011, American filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, catapulting them into an indefinite legal limbo. Neither Rothstein nor Vroom has recovered their air pass. A third customer also had his pass revoked. The other 25, including Mark Cuban's, are still valid. Now a substitute teacher in Dallas, Vroom has a theory. America was hurting, and they went after the most vulnerable air pass holders to free up cash. People they knew couldn't fight back. American Airlines declined to comment on the story or the program in general. And for Rothstein, is a bit more conclusive about the whole thing. He says, I wish I'd never bought the thing. On the walls of his New York office, it's a 1998 letter from Robert Crandall, the ex-president of American Airlines, says, you can count on us to honor the deal far into the future. So,
what do you think?
Well, I would like this pass. That would be nice.
It does seem like they could have used these guys for, like, marketing or, like, here are two people who obviously love their airline. Yeah. You would think they could have used them in better ways than, yeah. Like, is it your best customers you want to go
screwing over? It's absolute poppycock as they cost them $1 million a year. Absolute horseradish.
They're assuming people would be sitting in their seats. Is that the idea?
Look, the business class seats are predominantly made up of people upgrading. That's usually what happens, depending on the route.
Yeah.
But it's usually you buy it, and so then people get upgraded, and there's always a way. It's always full because people are waiting to bump up. There's a zero cost to that, the airline. And they're assuming every seat that they fly on would be full fee, fully refundable, fully changeable tickets, which yeah. Each one of those tickets can be anywhere from $1,000 to $9,000 domestically.
Yeah, it's a weird number.
And they're just sitting there going, you're costing us $1 million. No, no, no. They gave you money in your time of desperation, and they fulfilled the contract.
And why go after only those two people?
Yeah. There's something, you can't pass them down when they're dead. You just keep flying them, for crying out loud. What are you gonna... The two of your biggest flyers who took advantage of the offer you did, do you think that if one of those, maybe Cuban, or Cubes, as I know him, if he decided to no longer fly, or maybe he didn't use it,
yeah.
Would they give some of the money back?
No.
Of course not.
Yeah.
So you can't fault me the other way. No, I get it. Because look, I also understand a lot of times that cell phone companies have throttling on their bandwidth is because of the 1% of users that are just ripping down gigs per hour of just doing that. It's not everybody. It's one thing. I get that. But this is not about suffering of the entire customer base due to one guy going to get a sandwich. By the way, where the heck was the sandwich they're getting?
I was thinking in my head, like, Shake Shack's not up here. You're going the wrong direction.
What sandwich did he come up here to get? Was it poutine sandwich? Was it something I don't know about?
Even some of that sounds a little not true.
Yeah.
Like, it just sounds like a little bit, I don't know, like, it's not really any of our business why he flew to London 6,000 times.
You can live on an American Airlines plane. Just keep us hopping on flights.
None
You're allowed
of our business,
to.
Really.
He booked 3,000 and canceled 2,500. Book 40,000.
Yeah.
It's one seat rotating. You can handle it. It's not like you run one seat airlines and everybody's ready to go and then Jack doesn't show. because of that pass, and everybody's got to sit there. Your plane's still going. Somebody's still going to move to that seat in an upgrade when that person doesn't come.
Yeah.
Because they haven't checked in.
Plus, I mean, they made the deal. It was a desperate move, and it saved them, and they should be thankful for the people who saved them.
No, now it's costing us. Now it's costing you. Ridiculous industry.
This is an article from QZ, as I like to say, .com. It says, GM's dress code is only two words. When asked what men can do to improve women's lives at work, Mary Barra gets straight to the point. Stop making assumptions, she tells Quartz. As chief executive at General Motors, Barra practices what she preaches. Her management philosophy is epitomized by GM's workplace dress code, which is equally brief and also an antidote to the restrictive, wallet-draining policies of many large corporations. It reads, in full, dress appropriately.
End quote.
So we can all stand up and applaud because that's fantastic. And it says, having worked for GM since she was a teenager, first as a factory floor inspector, then scaling through leadership roles in engineering and communications, Barra was well acquainted with the automaker's bureaucracy by the time she became vice president of global human resources in 2009, months after the company filed for bankruptcy. Instead of immediately focusing on high-level restructuring strategies, Barra surprised her colleagues by tackling the small, seemingly inconsequential policies she knew were foundational to company culture. Her first battle, the dress code. She told the story at a Wharton People Analytics conference. Here's what she had to say. A lot gets set aside when you're going through a restructuring process. So it was an opportunity to really define our culture. So brainstorming with the HR department, I said, let's change the dress code. Let's make it dress appropriately. But the HR department ironically opposed my first hurdle. They started arguing with me, saying it can be dressed appropriately on the surface, but in the employee manual, it needs to be more detailed. They put in specifics like don't wear t-shirts that say inappropriate things or statements that could be misinterpreted. Barra was perplexed. Why does inappropriate in the context of a t-shirt even mean? She asked the audience, half jokingly. So I finally had to say, no, it's two words. That's what I want. What followed was really a window into the company for me. After replacing the 10-page dress code with the two-word appeal, Barra received a scathing email from a senior-level director. He said, you need to put out a better dress policy. This is not enough. So I called him, and of course, that shook him a little bit, and I asked him to help me understand why the policy was inept. The director explained that occasionally, some people on his team had to deal with government officials on short notice and had to be dressed appropriately for that. Okay, why don't you talk to your team, Barra replied. He was an established leader at GM, responsible for a pretty important part of the company with a multi-million dollar budget. He got back to me a few minutes later saying, I talked to the team, we brainstormed, and we agreed that for people who occasionally need to meet with government officials, we'll keep a pair of dress pants in their locker. Problem solved. And it says, simple as it means, it was an aha moment for Barra as a leader and for GM at large. Like, you're trusting them to work in your office. You're trusting them to speak to your customers. You're trusting them to meet with government officials. You've hired them. You don't trust them enough to understand what dress appropriately means? Really? Like, that's... Can you believe 10 pages before?
Right, dress code policy.
10 pages.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then people will stick to it. Now, mind you, we had a fairly casual Friday policy. And people just start showing up in jogging pants and a dirty sweater, and you're just like, no, yeah, no. It doesn't mean be unprofessional.
Yeah,
like it means like, come on.
I think it's just that when you're talking about people being hired, then you can have a conversation in an interview or a conversation and say like, look, this is how we do things on Friday. We have casual Friday jeans, sport jacket, whatever would be the most casual you can wear. Try and keep away from this and that and have it in a conversation. But to put a whole manual out together is a little crazy.
A few years ago, we saw it. I can't remember where the place was, but it was like a social media policy. It was just like, don't be an idiot. Like that was the whole policy. It was just like, come on, how do we...
I think that was Tony in Vegas.
Was it? I thought it was like a level like GE or something too, right?
Oh,
it was
really?
Just like, yeah,
I thought it was the
a big company. It was the New York Times.
Zappos.
Yeah, the same idea, right? Yeah. Which is just, come on, let's be adults.
Treat people.
And it gives managers an out, right? Where it's like, well, it's the policy, it's not me. Right? Yeah. It's just like, no, you have a serious conversation.
It also like tends to be so much like it's just inbred with sexism and discrimination, right? I mean, it's very hard to write the language of what's appropriate for, do you have different rules for women than you have for men? Do you have different ideas of what's appropriate for a woman than you do for a man? What about religious, you know, symbols and headpieces and all kinds? Like, there's just, it's so ripe for offense and stepping over the line, and you don't want that. So I think appropriate and then a conversation with another person that explains what the norm is, you know, it should be sufficient.
I agree, yeah. Sometimes a great way to kill culture is to out-policy it. That's really what it comes down to. And kudos to her as well, and apologies for using the term kudos, but for coming in and looking really at the ground level of problems. It's a good story for a mind the gap type of thing.
Yeah, right? For sure. I got a great appropriate compliment from our 11-year-old this week.
Yeah,
I bought a dress and I brought it home and I showed it to her. And for the first time, part of the compliment was, oh, it's so pretty and it's not too young.
Oh!
Which is both a burn and a compliment wrapped together. So I just smiled.
It's a burn lament.
Yeah, it wasn't, that was the first time anyone's ever told me that. You did a good job and it's not too young for you. Yeah, dress appropriately.
You still get ID'd when we go to places. That's the funny part.
I thought it was funny that she
said that. How old do they think you are and how old do they think I am?
They think you have a problem.
Yeah. 11 months. That's the difference in age here, kids. Come on. 11 months, not 11 years. Oy. All right, from the BBC, from across the pond. Weatherspoon pub chain quits social media. What? This caused a fire.
What are we going to do without them?
In social media circles, which are shrinking every single month. Media. Pub chain JD Weatherspoon has used Twitter to tell its 44,000 followers that it's quitting social media.
I love when people use social media to quit social media. That's my favorite.
It's like that college humor video of the guy. If people left parties like they left Facebook. Yeah. It has come to my attention that this party has gone downhill, and I'm going to give you the reasons why I am leaving. It just stands there. The firm's head office and 900 pubs will quit the microblogging site and also Instagram and Facebook with immediate effect. The pub chain linked the move to bad publicity surrounding social media, including the trolling of MPs. Chairman Tim Martin told the BBC that society would be better off if people cut the amount of social media use. The firm said its decision has also been influenced by concerns regarding the misuse of personal data and the addictive nature of social media. We are going against conventional wisdom that these platforms are a vital component of a successful business. He told the BBC that he had always thought the idea that social media was essential for advertising was untrue. We were also concerned that pub managers were being sidetracked from the real job of serving customers. I don't believe that closing these accounts will affect our business whatsoever. The chairman said that it had consulted its pub managers before making the move, and 90-95% felt using social media was not helping their business. Mr. Martin told BBC Radio 5 Live that he thinks coming off social media would be good for society in general. He said that if people limited their social media to half hour each day, they'd be mentally and physically better off. He added, I find most people I know waste their time on it. A lot of them say they know they waste their time, but they struggle to get off of it.
I like how he used it as a PR opportunity to go on TV.
But he said the pub chain has certainly put plenty of effort into it until now with hundreds of different Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts. But the truth is that none had won much of a mass following, and those who ran the accounts were not doing a very good job. A tweet pushing fish and chips on Good Friday just got 3 retweets. Managing an effective social media strategy and making sure staff running so many accounts stick to company policy is also very time-consuming. The pub chain has more than 100,000 Facebook followers and more than 6,000 on Instagram, both relatively small totals. Oof, okay. Asked whether Weatherspoon's move could start a business trend, Mr. Martin said he hoped not. Currently, we've got a massive commercial advantage because everyone else is wasting hours of their time.
So they quit something they aren't very good at, and they used it as a marketing ploy to be on TV.
Yeah, well done.
Yeah, good trip.
Well, yeah,
it's fine. It's up to them. If that's what they want to do, they should do it.
And a bunch of people sent this to
good
us.
Good for them.
And a bunch of people sent it to me and said, what do you think? And I'm like, good.
Yeah, it's fine.
I don't know how many times we have got to say this. You don't need to use it. The person that says you have to be using something is the one who's selling it.
Especially if they weren't using it very well. And like if they didn't have the time or the energy. 900 pubs? Yeah.
900 locations. It's hard enough for a mom and pop shop to run it because they're running a business.
Yeah.
But 900 with all different voices and response rates. And it's just a train wreck.
Yeah.
Right? Understanding one corporate account and stuff too, fine. But at the end of the day, you're a local place. Your focus is on the people walking in there.
Yeah.
I hope they would still look at reviews. I hope they'd still look at that type of stuff to see getting that litmus kind of temperature of your clientele. But the answer is no, you don't have to. When we ate at Hell's Kitchen in Vegas, you know, did them being on or off Twitter influence us going there?
No, but I think like the promise of social media was that you could get that sort of, because we went to Hell's Kitchen because we might have tried it if it was called Joe's Diner, I don't know. But part of that was the draw of the famous chef and the TV show and the media and the stuff that they've done on social media. So that certainly brought us in the door. But just like anything, it's a tool. So if it brings us in the door, what amazed us was how good it was. We're not going back because it was a celebrity that did it or they tweet about this or they use social media well. We're going back because the food was really good. Right. I think that they aren't using the channel in the way that they could use the channel, in my opinion. But stepping away from it is by far a good, sounds like a really good decision for them. Yeah. Because what they're probably doing is just upsetting people who aren't getting responded to and aren't getting, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like to me, when I hear they put out a sale, fish and chips special, and it only got 3 retweets, I'm like, they haven't done any time. They haven't spent any time. What you talked about a few episodes ago, how much have they given? Do they share other people's posts? Do they engage in conversation with people in their community? I'm thinking probably they don't. And if they just use it to push out sales, no one's, I'm not going to retweet a ship it, chip in, yeah, a ship and chips? What was I trying to say?
That works.
Fish and chips special with a company that I have no relationship with, right?
Well, we wrote a chapter on that about kids don't play in crappy playgrounds.
Yeah.
Right, and that was about a research article about people that saying don't build a playground in an apartment because we took a survey and nobody said they used it because it was terrible in the first place. Can Twitter or social media in general help a pub or 900 pubs in a chain? Yeah. And no. It depends, yeah. Right? What do you, if you're not using it well and it doesn't work, yeah, shut it down. Shut it all down. Do you want to have different avenues your customers or your potential customers can get in touch with you to make a reservation? I don't know if they even take reservations. You want to find out what the specials are? Will it help me buy? Then great. Is that email? Is that Facebook Messenger? Is that, and if you want to shut those down, it's up to you.
I do wish they hadn't laced it with the moral conversation around being online.
Let's relax.
That was completely unnecessary, in my opinion. But
but just say what they said at the start. It's just, it's too many places, too many people needing to focus on the... Somebody said this to me once at a Bell Canada store. So it's one of our national cell phone providers or just phone providers. And I went in once to our location just down the street and the phone was ringing. Ironically, the phone was ringing right beside the person helping me out. And I'm like, and I looked at it. I said, do you want to get that? Like, do you want to answer it? Because it just kept ringing.
Yeah.
She's like, nope. You came in. You came in here, so you get my attention.
Yeah.
And they'll call back. And it's just like focusing on the guests you have, the customers you have.
If they're saying it's distracting their employees, absolutely. Yeah. Like, lock that down. You're not going to be able to keep your employees off social media, though. I have a hard time believing that their employees were distracted tweeting on behalf of the company. Probably they were distracted looking at their phones at their own lives. But that's a different problem, right?
Yeah.
I have an article here, and I'm going to try really hard not to mispronounce Bloomberg's editor-in-chief's name. So, new Bloomberg rule, at least one woman on panels. Bloomberg editor-in-chief John Micklethwaite announced a new policy on outside speaking engagements for Bloomberg journalists as an expansion of the newsroom's effort to promote gender equality and diversity. The new policy requires that at least one woman be on a panel in order for Bloomberg journalists to participate. The woman could be a Bloomberg journalist. Here's an excerpt. In recent weeks, I've written a lot about our efforts to promote gender equality and diversity. This also needs to extend to our outside speaking engagements and the need to make sure women speakers appear on panels. We will henceforth follow the same standard that several other news organizations and our own conference unit are adopting. If you are asked to participate on a panel as a speaker or a moderator, you should ensure there is at least one woman panelist prior to asking for approval. At the risk of stating the obvious, the woman could be you. If the panelists are not finalized when you are first asked to participate, please inform the organizers of this requirement, kindly explaining that if it can't be met, you will have to decline. If you still think there's a case for being on a male-only panel, if you were, for instance, to moderate a panel of Catholic cardinals or members of the Chinese Politburo, please explain it to, and then has the information for who they should get in touch with. And it says, if an organization needs suggested names for the panel, feel free to recommend from our own database. I like this.
I think it's great. I think that so in the back channel of the speaking industry, there's always talk about underrepresentation of women either through keynotes or through speaking on agendas or on panels and what to do about it. And there was a few speakers in Australia that came out and said they won't keynote conferences that don't have as close a parity as possible when it comes to male, female. I think it's important. There's the, because it's true. It's very underrepresented.
Especially when it's done in this kind of way where it's a group and it's internal. It becomes an internal rule. And then, you know, if you want a Bloomberg panelist on your panel at your conference, you have to do A, B, C, and D, and this is A. And then it becomes the norm after a while, after it gets seen. And it opens up an opportunity for people to be able to hear from women speakers, which made them make them think, I should be speaking. And I think it's important.
Yeah, it's
a tough thing to do by yourself. I like that they're doing it as a group.
Yeah, it's one of the first times I've seen this. It is the first time I've seen a company come out with a policy trying to help a gender parity in their conferences. Well played. Do we have a question?
Oh, yeah, we have a question. I'm going to give you a choice.
Okay.
You want a question about video and content, or you want a question about a new business?
Hmm.
3, 2, 1.
Yes.
No, you got to pick one of them. Which one? New business?
Sure.
Okay. This is from Daniel Dutton, and it says, starting to build my own business, custom woodworking. What would be your top 2 tips? He only wants 2. I'm adding that. For success in starting your own business. So kind of an if you could go back, I guess. Top 2 tips.
Everything will cost twice as much, take twice as long, you make half as much money. That's your life tip right there for it. I think one of the big, I always get it from big ass fans, is treat your vendors, your employees, and your customers equally well.
Yeah.
Especially in that type of business where you're needing supplies, you're needing something else where... and that's why we try to do that too. We try to pay on time. We try to be kind to everybody going around the business because you never know when you need that hand.
Yeah.
I know if he went to Wayne and said, we can't pay you this month, he would say, no problem.
This month, but there'll be interest applied till next month.
But you know, but that's what I mean. You want to be good to work with.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is in something like an art form, whether that's
woodworking
or furniture or cabinetry or anything else, it's just, there's an art to that.
Yeah.
And I find art sometimes becomes very personal and you forget who the client is.
Yeah.
The client wants something, right? And I was always, it's like music, right? When I used to manage bands, it was, well, this is the song and I'm not going to compromise it. And I said, well, do you want to play to yourself? Or do you want to, you know, get something on the charts? And it was just this conversation. Sometimes it's a compromise the other. So understanding that who the client is. I thought for a very long time that as a keynote speaker, I was the main attraction. I was the big thing. When in reality, I'm a vendor. You know, I'm a one of many. And that's important. And service and be patient.
Yeah.
It takes a long time. It takes a word of mouth takes a long time. Building a reputation takes a long time. Then it takes one bad thing to ruin it. You know, always act like somebody else's, your entire customer base is watching on a live feed and stand behind your work.
I would say to read and listen to and talk to as many entrepreneurs or creation stories about founders and people who had ideas, because I think that there's a lot that we think we know that we don't, and you can't know what you don't know. You learn it along the way. And a lot of entrepreneurship is learning along the way. Obviously, most likely, you have this great skill in woodworking. So you have a gift and a talent and a skill that you've hopefully practiced at before you're starting your own business. But that's just the thing. There's so much around starting a business that is similar between almost every business. Like, you think you're special because you're starting a business, but really, it's not that different to the challenges that, like, people who started a computer business or people who started a furniture business or people who started a service business. There's a lot of similarities. And so reading about the challenges and the lessons that people who've already been through that experience, sometimes they've learned more from the mistakes that they've made than what they did right. I've learned so much just from listening and reading other people's stories and getting to know other entrepreneurs and trying not to be isolated by it, because it's fairly isolating. So I think that that would be something that I think is really important. And then I think just, I mean, for me, is just the organization side of things. That doesn't come to me necessarily naturally, but the fruits of it at the other side of keeping clean books and keeping a set accounts of where you're going, you're scheduling really clean. There's all kinds of apps and stuff that can help you organize all that stuff. You'll be thankful in the end of 6 months when you have to do taxes or something that you started out writing everything down and keeping really clean books, because it's a lot harder to go back through a box of receipts and try and find, like, you know, the things you didn't do. And if you're going to have stresses because it's a new business, so anything you can de-stress, like bookkeeping, like being organized about receipts, like keeping proper notes, that doesn't have to be chaotic, because the chaos is going to come out of your control, I think makes a really big difference in that first kind of year of things. That's like 18 pieces of advice from both of us. So he got his money worth.
There's your two. Pick your two.
Thank you.
And thank all of you.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel, for your question.
Thank you for your time and your patience and your hearts.
We should start a business.
No. Too tired. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and visit theunpodcast.com. And remember, friends don't let friends use QR codes.